Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, March 4th, 2025. We begin with local news, Mayoral Candidates Talk Housing Issues at IWU by Brendan Dennison. Affordable housing, good infrastructure, public safety, and other quality of life issues are as important to Illinois Wesleyan University students as they are to the community as a whole, Bloomington mayoral candidates said on Sunday. About 50 people turned out at IWU's Memorial Center to hear from former State Representative Dan Brady, a Republican from Bloomington, Bloomington Ward 6 Alderman Cody Hendricks, and incumbent Mboka Milwambwe, IWU students quizzed them at a forum intended to increase interest on campus in the April 1st local election. Discussions were largely cordial throughout the event, with candidates generally focusing on similar priorities, with an eye toward attracting and retaining IWU students to live and work in Bloomington. One issue that evoked some emotion on the panel stage involved LGBTQ+ protections. When asked to present his top three goals as a candidate, Brady said he'd focus on public safety, city infrastructure, including water quality, and city services. He said affordable housing follows those, noting the city can continue to build up housing through infrastructure improvements and streamlining zoning processes. Hendricks said his goals begin with housing affordability and include revitalizing downtown Bloomington through streetscape improvement and infrastructure work. Like Brady, Hendricks noted infrastructure work feeds into other areas like water quality. Wilwambwe said he and the other candidates would likely focus on similar topics because, quote, what municipalities do doesn't really tend to shift a lot over the years. The current mayor said public safety is a basic need and it's high on his priority list. You need to have safety before anything, noting the city's safety makes it possible for IWU to recruit and retain students and staff. Public safety is incredibly important for Illinois Wesleyan and just about anybody. Wilwambwe, then added, he's very interested in investing more in water infrastructure and street resurfacing, as well as addressing housing challenges. The event was organized by IWU's Student Senate and Center for Engagement and included questions submitted in advance to the candidates and others solicited from the IWU community. Center interns Griffin Owen and Kaylin Pavlicek asked the questions. Hendricks, a Pekin native who teaches economics and history at Olympia High School in rural Stanford, recalled paying $750 a month in rent when he moved to Bloomington in 2016. That same apartment now rents for $1,800, he said, calling housing a real crisis. He said the city council has tried to promote initiatives that encourage housing developments that would include providing the missing middle components, duplexes and triplexes. Revising zoning codes to allow accessible dwelling units could be another avenue for added housing, he said. Hendricks also suggested reducing minimum parking lot size requirements to encourage developers. After Pavlicek asked how candidates could quickly bring down housing costs for IWU students, Wilwambwe said that's very difficult to do. He said the city's zoning board and council are trying to bring more housing online through several initiatives, including a standardized incentive package for developers. Wilwambwe also said 1,000 units are currently in development. As much as I would hate to disappoint, it's not a quick way to address that, he said, before adding, the city needs to be laser-focused on working with developers to bring new housing to Bloomington as soon as possible. Responding to Pavlicek's question, Hendricks said he grew up very low income and that representation matters in local government. Citing his experience serving on the State House Committee for Higher Education Appropriations, Brady said the first step to dealing with housing is finding out what the needs are. Brady said he'd also consider combining areas of city government that deal with zoning, including committees that don't meet sometimes because they don't have a quorum. He said he'd ensure those issues would be worked out so that the city could move forward with zoning changes in a timely manner. Willamwe said picking his top goals as mayor is like a parent trying to pick their favorite child. He said his fourth priority goal would be improving the quality of life in Bloomington. We have young people who are looking for things to do. You're coming into this community from other places where you had a different quality of life. So we need to make sure that we provide that quality of life for you, he said. The mayor said such investments the city has made include renovation of the Bloomington Public Library, which wrapped up last year, and bringing the Bloomington Bison hockey team to the Grossinger Motors Arena. Willamwe, who prior to becoming mayor was Ward 3 alderman from 2017 to 2021, highlighted the renovation of the O'Neill Aquatic Center as another accomplishment. Parks are like a living room of the community, he said. It's important to have, and it helps to strengthen all of us. Willamwe said IWU Knights at Bison Games on Wednesdays encouraged Titans to be part of Bloomington, and he suggested creating internships or appointments for high school and college students on city boards and commissions. Some of you who are here as students, we're hoping to keep you in the community. If you enjoy yourself in the community, I think you're more likely to stay, said Willamwe, who works as Assistant Director of the Office of Equal Opportunity and Access at Illinois State University in Normal. On the matter of street repairs, Brady said he's been asked why infrastructure budgets running upward of $96 million a year aren't enough to fix potholes and do other things in the community. Brady said a mayor needs to be able to lead and be capable of telling agencies responsible for those tasks that progress needs to be year-round and not start at a certain time frame. It's about helping those who need help in the very government they offer us, he said, adding constituents have called him because they can't reach anyone else. Brady, associate director of the Kibler Brady Restman Memorial Home in Bloomington, served as McLean County coroner before spending more than 20 years in the House until his unsuccessful bid in 2022 for Secretary of State. He said one of his top accomplishments as a public servant was getting to help cut through the red tape of government. Asking to share his accomplishments as a public servant, Hendricks said he worked day and night with downtown business owners and residents on creating a streetscape plan that made sense for them. He added that while there's work to be done, he has worked to secure votes from the council supporting the plan. Hendricks said he also was proud to help add language to the city code to bolster anti-discrimination protections. Near the end of the panel discussion, candidates were asked how they'd protect the diversity of students within the current political landscape. The community and feeling that you're protected in the community is so important no matter what your makeup is, the color of your skin, or sexual orientation, Brady said. He added that if people don't feel safe, they don't want to come to your community. Hendricks, who said he is part of the LGBTQ+ community, said he would extend those same protections to others. While he did not name Brady during the panel, Hendricks said his opponent voted against legalizing same-sex marriage and teaching LGBTQ+ history in schools in Illinois. It's pretty awkward to be a gay history teacher on this stage and hear words that say safety. But when the votes come down, it didn't go that way, Hendricks said. After the event, Hendricks confirmed he was referencing Brady. In closing comments, Brady asked voters to consider who has the contacts and experience to work with businesses and the state and federal government to address the city's infrastructure issues. Many people like to practice and preach different things. No room for hate, only love. But that's not what they practice, Brady said. Next, we have Freeze May Thaw for Some Energy Grants by Nara Schoenberg with the Chicago Tribune. With the fight over a federal clean energy funding freeze entering its second month, two of the biggest prizes in Illinois are emissions reduction grants totaling more than $570 million. Now the state appears closer to claiming both of them. Money from an expected $430 million in federal climate pollution reduction grants was blocked until February 19th. But the state can now access it, according to a written statement from Governor J.B. Pritzker's office. Part of a $148 million national electric vehicle infrastructure grant for public EV chargers also appears to be within reach. The federal government has legally committed to pay the state $25.3 million of the NEVI grant funds, according to the governor's office. The state will continue to pursue every option available to ensure we receive the funds promised to us, the statement said. The state's progress comes at a time of uncertainty for clean energy, kicked off by President Donald Trump's strongly worded executive orders, freezing federal funding for a wide range of decarbonization projects, including those created or expanded by President Joe Biden's signature climate law, the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act. Two federal judges have issued orders requiring the Trump administration to unfreeze trillions of dollars in funding for a wide range of projects, including clean energy. Lawyers for the Trump Justice Department have argued that the president and the Office of Management and Budget, quote, plainly have authority to direct agencies to fully implement the president's agenda, consistent with each individual agency's underlying statutory authorities, close quote, according to the Associated Press. In Illinois, which aims for 100% clean energy by 2050, the effects of the clean energy funding freeze have been felt by small nonprofits as well as major state agencies. I think right now, the summary is chaos and uncertainty, which is not something you want to see with these programs, said Illinois Environmental Council Executive Director Jen Walling. Walling, whose organization is tracking the effects of the freeze, said that some nonprofits that expected federal clean energy grants either don't know if they'll get them or have heard of some sort of cancellation. I can't give details, but I definitely know that nonprofits have already started to look at or started to perform layoffs based on federal funding maybe not being available in the future, she said. At Slipstream, a Wisconsin nonprofit focused on building decarbonization, Managing Director of Policy Robin Lisowski said that federal funds have been frozen and unfrozen multiple times. I've heard from multiple organizations and different levels of government in multiple states that was the experience, she said. In Illinois, the NEVI grants have been of particular concern in part because Trump singled out the program in one of his executive orders, and in part because much of the money has not yet been awarded to the companies that will build the chargers. The $25.3 million that the state says the federal government is legally committed to paying would fund 37 charging stations across the state, including in Decatur, Minonk, Champaign, and Arcola in central Illinois. It is unclear whether Illinois will retain the rest of the NEVI grant money. The U.S. Department of Transportation, which administers the grants, did not respond to a request for comment. In January, Environmental Law and Policy Center CEO Howard Lerner told the Tribune that NEVI funds are under more direct presidential control than, say, solar energy tax credits or EV tax credits. With NEVI, the administration does have a degree of flexibility and can decide, with regard to new expenditures, whether to move forward or not, Lerner said. Walling is more optimistic about the climate pollution reduction grants, which were announced in July. I think that money is pretty well locked up, and after some discussion, it's going to go where it needs to go, and it's going to get paid out, Walling said. Those grants will fund products in 5 priority areas, according to the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency website: clean and efficient buildings, clean transportation and freight, industrial decarbonization, climate smart agriculture, and clean power. In total, those projects will reduce more than 57 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions over the next 25 years, according to the Illinois EPA. In state news also, we have defendant pleads guilty to Highland Park parade shooting. Development comes before opening statements by Sophia Tureen with the Associated Press. A 24-year-old man pleaded guilty Monday to killing 7 people and injuring dozens more when he opened fire on a 2022 Independence Day parade in a Chicago suburb. A stunning development moments before opening statements in his trial on charges of murder and attempted murder. Appearing in a Lake County Circuit Courtroom, Robert E. Cremo III withdrew his earlier not guilty plea in the Highland Park shooting. Prosecutors initially charged him with 21 counts of first-degree murder, 3 counts for each person killed, as well as 48 counts of attempted murder. Prosecutors dropped 48 less serious counts of aggravated battery before jury selection last week. On Monday, Judge Victoria Rossetti read the charges to Cremo and asked questions to be sure he understood before any opening plea was read to the court. He was sitting next to his lawyers wearing a dark suit. "Is that what you went over with your attorneys?" Rossetti asked. "Yes," Cremo replied to the judge. He gave one-word answers, indicating he understood the charges. His mother, Denise Pacina, had a brief outburst at the news and was called up to the judge for a warning. The judge said with the plea change, there would be no trial or further motions on the case. Lake County prosecutors read the names of all those killed in the shooting and of those injured, with the judge stopping to ask questions to make sure Cremo understood. They went over the substantial evidence, including his prints on the gun used in the crime and statements to police admitting to the mass shooting. Sentencing will come April 23rd. But Cremo is certain to spend the rest of his life behind bars. Each count of first-degree murder carries a natural life prison sentence. Cremo did not further address the court or ask questions before leaving the courtroom. His defense attorneys declined comment ahead of the trial. The change of plea shocked those gathered in the courtroom, including survivors of the shooting. Ashby Beasley, who attended the 2022 parade with her son, said it was a huge relief. She said they had to run for their lives, and even though they weren't injured, they have had to heal. Seeing Cremo at hearings has added to their trauma. "Every time I see him, it's stressful. It's upsetting for everyone in our community," she told reporters after court. "We all just wanted this to be over." The trial was expected to last about a month, with testimony from survivors and police. Prosecutors had submitted thousands of pages of evidence, as well as hours of videotaped interrogation, during which police say Cremo confessed to the shooting. The criminal case proceeded slowly for months, partly due to Cremo's unpredictable behavior. In June of 2024, when he was expected to accept a plea deal and give victims and relatives a chance to address him publicly, Cremo showed up to court in a wheelchair and rejected the deal, surprising even his lawyers. He also fired his public defenders and said he would represent himself. Then he abruptly reversed himself. The trial came almost 2 years after his father faced separate charges connected to how Cremo obtained a gun license. In 2019, at age 19, Cremo was only allowed to apply for a gun license with the sponsorship of a parent or guardian. His father agreed, even though a relative had reported to police that his son had a collection of knives and had threatened to kill everyone. His father, Robert Cremo Jr., a one-time mayoral candidate, was charged in connection with how his son obtained a gun license. He pleaded guilty in 2023 to 7 misdemeanor counts of reckless conduct and served less than 2 months in jail. He has attended his son's hearings, sometimes making eye contact with him during court. He declined to discuss the case in detail ahead of the trial. As a parent, I love my son very much, he said, and Bobby loves this country more than anyone would ever know. The victims killed in the shooting included Catherine Goldstein, 64, Jacqueline Sundheim, 63, Stephen Strauss, 88, Nicholas Toledo Zaragoza, 78, Eduardo Uvaldo, 69, and married couple Kevin McCarthy, 37, and Irina McCarthy, 35. Survivors and their families have filed multiple lawsuits, including against the maker of the semi-automatic rifle used in the shooting and against authorities they accuse of negligence. In another court case, we have ComEd 4 retrial ordered. Bribery ruling impacts case tied to Madigan by Jason Meisner with the Chicago Tribune. A federal judge Monday granted a new trial on some counts in the ComEd 4 case involving former House Speaker Michael Madigan, saying the Supreme Court's ruling last year on a key bribery statute means the jury was not instructed properly. In making his ruling, however, U.S. District Judge Manish Shah left intact the convictions on a number of other counts, including the charges of cooking ComEd's books to hide the bribery scheme. Assistant U.S. Attorney Amarjeet Bakku told the judge he still needs to consult with his bosses. However, he anticipates they will want to proceed to sentencing on the counts that remain, which by statute could include long prison terms rather than to retry the bribery accounts. The ComEd 4 defendants, former ComEd CEO Anne Pramaggiore, Madigan confidant and longtime lobbyist Michael McLean, internal ComEd lobbyist John Hooker, and consultant Jay Dotary, were convicted in May 2023 in an alleged scheme by the utility to funnel payments to Madigan favored contractors in exchange for the longtime Democratic speaker's influence over legislation in Springfield. Shah's ruling comes 3 weeks after Madigan, once the most powerful politician in the state, was found guilty of bribery, conspiracy, and other corruption charges, alleging he used his public office to increase his power, line his own pockets, and enrich a small circle of his most loyal associates. But neither prosecutors nor Madigan could declare total victory in that case either. Jurors' final verdict was overall mixed, deadlocking on several accounts, including the marquee racketeering conspiracy charge, and acquitting Madigan on numerous others. Jurors also deadlocked on all six counts related to McLean. In their motion for a new trial, defense lawyers in the ComEd 4 case argued the entire prosecution was built on a rotten foundation, and the charges should be dismissed in light of the Supreme Court's opinion in Snyder. From the outset of this case, the government maintained that giving things of value to a powerful politician as a reward for past acts or to curry favor without a quid pro quo is criminal, the ComEd 4 defense teams argued in the motion. On that foundation, the government built an edifice of overlapping charges. But as with all structures, if the foundation is rotten, the structure will fall. And in Snyder v. U.S., the Supreme Court confirmed that the government's theory has been rotten from the start. Close quote. Since the case relied heavily on allegations of gratuities, sentencings have been delayed since January 2024, while the parties awaited the Snyder decision. Meanwhile, the judge who had presided over the trial, Harry Lineweber, died in June 2024 at age 87, and the case was reassigned to Shaw. The defense motion said the prosecutor's theory of the case was wrongheaded from the get-go, including the grand jury, where they told the panel it could indict the defendants on the conspiracy charge based on the legal conduct of paying a gratuity. The same ComEd allegations formed the backbone of the racketeering indictment of Madigan and McLean. And returning to a bit of local news, we have new dean chosen for ISU's Milner Library by Brendan Dennison. Illinois State University is checking in a new dean for Milner Library. Carrie Forbes will take over the top library post July 1, 2025, succeeding Dallas Long, who has held the position since July 2020. In an announcement issued Friday, Annie Yazdejian, Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost for the University, said Forbes has extensive administrative library experience and a strong background in assessment, collaborative research initiatives, community engagement, and education policy. Forbes is currently Dean of the School of Undergraduate Studies in the University of Library at Southern Oregon University in Ashland, Oregon. Under her leadership, Hannon Library at SOU has made significant strides in enhancing its services to support both student learning and faculty research, according to ISU's announcement. Forbes's academic credentials include a bachelor's degree in history from Western Michigan University, a master's degree in library science from Indiana University, a master's degree in higher education from the University of Denver, and a doctorate in education from the University of Denver. In a statement, Forbes said she looks forward to joining the library's team as they work to ensure that Milner Library continues to be a hub for academic excellence, innovation, and collaboration. Yazdejian also expressed her appreciation to Long for his invaluable leadership and commitment to the Milner Library. And we have a speech to watch. Musk, Ukraine, tone things to look for in Trump address, by Chris Marigan with the Associated Press. Donald Trump loves a good spectacle, and it's hard to top a speech to a joint session of Congress. The House chamber is packed with lawmakers, and the president's arrival is announced in a booming voice by the sergeant at arms, triggering loud applause. Trump's speech on Tuesday evening isn't technically considered a State of the Union address. That comes next year, after he's been on the job for longer. But there's no distinguishable difference for anyone watching at home. Almost no detail is left to chance in these situations. Here's an idea of what to look and listen for. The most powerful people in American government are usually on the dais during an event like this. While the president addresses the nation, the House Speaker and the Vice President, who doubles as the ceremonial leader of the Senate, sit behind him. However, they've been largely overshadowed by Elon Musk, the billionaire entrepreneur overseeing the Department of Government Efficiency and serving as a top advisor to Trump. There's no precedent for Musk's operation, which has burrowed into federal agencies, led to thousands of firings and counting, and rewired how Washington works. Special guests at presidential speeches often sit above the chamber in the gallery. Will Musk, the world's richest person, be there or somewhere else? It's been only a few days since the most dramatic encounter in the Oval Office in recent memory. Trump welcomed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to solidify a partnership involving critical minerals, only for a deal to fall apart after Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance laced into Zelensky over a perceived lack of respect. Now the future of U.S. support for Ukraine, which has been fending off a Russian invasion for 3 years, is increasingly in doubt. You either make a deal or we are out, Trump told Zelensky. With Russia trying to press its advantage on the battlefield, does Zelensky patch things up? Will fragile U.S. relationships with European allies deteriorate even further? There are no clear answers right now, but Tuesday's speech will be a high-profile opportunity for Trump, a Republican, to explain his vision for the war and his approach to foreign policy. And how do lawmakers behave? Presidential speeches to Congress have become rowdier affairs. Representative Joe Wilson, a South Carolina Republican, famously shouted, "You lie," at President Barack Obama's address to Congress in 2009, and decorum hasn't improved much since then. How will Democrats respond? Sometimes their protests have been quiet, such as when women wore white, the color of the suffragette movement, to previous events. But at a time when Democratic voters have been eager for their representatives to be more aggressive, it's possible they may become more vocal. Reaction from Republicans is more predictable. Expect them to try to outdo one another with their embrace of the president. And with that, we conclude the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, March 4th, 2025. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.